from the Simeon Studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another Barrel of Monkeys Hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Are you tired of having a mass of monkeys devour your garden goodies? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll help a listener in Japan defeat those relentless foes. Plus, a first look at the brand new Square Foot Gardening book. And your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and naturally nuanced nullifications. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up faster than you tripping up a troop by renting a U-Haul.
Thank you to the members of WDIY for making all the programming you hear possible. Becoming a WDIY member is the best way to support your listening and to ensure WDIY will be here for the next person in our community to discover. Make your membership gift today at 610-694-8100 extension 4 or wdiy.org. We couldn't be here without you.
From the still festive studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we feature a story that combines Halloween and Christmas traditions from other nations, each featuring a humble and underutilized vegetable, which we are calling Celebrate Two Holidays with Turnips. A New York Times story that ran in local papers a few days before Christmas featured a large photo of a turnip being carved in an attempt to win some serious prize money in Oaxaca, Mexico, where the turnip carving contest dates back 120 years. We'll get back to that story in a moment, but I have to stop here and recount research I did decades ago after hearing that the original jack-o'-lanterns were large turnips carved at Halloween in the UK, especially in my ancestral Ireland, where they didn't know about pumpkins, but were famous for having a climate that grew exceptional root crops. Thus, large turnips were prized for carving into lanterns that resembled the one the original Jack carried as he roamed the countryside. Jack was said to have been a blacksmith who made an unholy deal with the devil and was thus banned from entering heaven. But the devil didn't want him either, and Jack was cursed to roam the countryside with the nighttime help of light from a devil's lantern, a large turnip into which had been carved a hideous face, lit from the inside by a candle or burning coal. Look up Irish jack-o'-lanterns online, and you'll see that these creations were much more frightening than any of our Halloween carved pumpkins. Back to Oaxaca and a very different holiday. As Times reporter James Wagner relates, every December 23rd, this city in southern Mexico comes to a near standstill for a simple vegetable, as crowds gather for the annual Night of the Radishes, where locals transform the root vegetables into extravagant works of art. This year, he explains, the intricate carvings included nativity scenes, Days of the Dead displays, and depictions of indigenous mythology. What began as local vendors decorating their vegetable and fish stands at a Christmas market evolved into a contest back in 1897. The radish became the official medium because it was abundant and easy to carve. A state decree protects the yearly event, and the city provides 12 tons of radishes all for free to the participants. Ah, but that's not the only thing Oaxaca provides. Carvings that receive first place are awarded the equivalent of $1,500, with other cash awards extending all the way down to 20th place. Any resident of Oaxaca can compete, and there is no entry fee. Ah, but there are those generous cash prizes. This year's winner, Jose Domingo Loria Aquino, who together with his family carved a replica of the city's outdoor fish and vegetable market, came home on winter break from college in Chicago to compete and has, quote, vowed to defend his title next year.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, before we get on with the show, I have to thank those of you who have put up with our blessed repeats for quite a while now and explain that I am back in the driver's seat and I am almost finished recovering from the pneumonia that knocked me out for a month. Yes, you've all seen the news reports about record levels of RSV, flu, COVID, but I hit the jackpot. I got to pick a prize from the top shelf. I got pneumonia, but I'm getting better, and thank you for the patience. Enjoy this new show, and we'll bring another one to you next week. Number to call, 610-694-8100. Diane, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Diane. How are you?
We're very good. It's a little cold here today, but good time to start working on our beds.
Okay. Where are you located?
We're just right outside Nashville, Tennessee.
Excellent. Excellent. I can't tell you how much I enjoy being on the air in Nashville and Memphis. It makes me feel like a country music star.
Well, that's where we listen to you.
Yeah, very good. What's the call letters?
WPLN.
All right. Shout out to them. What can we do you for, Diane?
Well, about 10 years ago, Mike helped me build 6 raised beds for my vegetable garden.
Excellent.
Each year since then, I've added some compost, mostly like the black cow that I can get at Lowe's.
Stop. That's not compost. That is
manure.
That is composted cow manure from factory farms.
Ah.
No relationship to compost whatsoever.
So you don't recommend that, right?
Well, cow manure is interesting in that it is a very balanced level of nutrients compared to horse manure or poultry manure. But I worry about all the medications given to the animals in situations where it's easy to correct their waste. If you're not worried about the antibiotics and the growth regulators, nutritionally, it's balanced. But you used compost. Do you make your own compost?
No, I can't seem to get my compost bed hot enough to kill all the seeds.
Go online, buy a copy of my out-of-print book, which is available through secondary sources, Mike McGrath's Book of Compost. It will make you a master composter in one season.
Okay.
So how many bags of this dried cow manure are you adding?
Well, I've just added a few bags as I went along. I haven't added like a truckload of anything. Mostly, in the fall, I shred leaves and cover the beds with shredded leaves.
Okay, that is almost composting. Those leaves, as they break down, it's very wise to cover your beds over the winter and also to use shredded leaves to mulch in the growing season to prevent weeds. But so far, that's the best thing you're doing. Don't pull back on that. That's excellent. Now, did you have a question about the soil in your beds?
I do. After this amount of time, it's gotten compacted. I was surprised when I went to plant my fall vegetables how compacted the soil was. I could barely use my trowel to bust it up to plant my lettuce. And it's dropped. When I first built them, they were within an inch or so of the top of the bed. And now they're like 4 inches from the top of the bed.
Let me drop back for a second. When you first built them, what did you fill them with?
I filled them with, I have a nursery that's just down the street, and they have a raised bed soil. It's supposed to be topsoil, compost, soil conditioner, and sand.
Okay, that's good. Do you buy it in bulk?
Yes. We have a little trailer. We can go get a scoop of it in.
Okay. I like that combination. And 10 years, you're right on the money. That's around the time, even though we don't step in our raised bed, gravity and the components shrinking will eventually make the soil compacted, even though we're not responsible. There's essentially one way to do this, but two methods. What you want to do is what we always advise not to do, but it's perfectly fine to do every 10 years, is go out there. If manual labor is your idea of a good time, you would double dig with a garden fork, which is as simple as using the fork to move the soil around and lighten it up. And I recommend that you get a big bag or two of perlite. It is a miracle soil conditioner. But don't buy the bag that says miracle because they've added chemical fertilizers to it. You just want regular perlite, which comes in huge bags, is very inexpensive, and you can show off to your neighbors because this bag, the size of a small child, weighs about 4 pounds. And you would mix.
So can I get that at most garden centers? Or?
Yeah, a garden center would be your best bet. You know, tell them you're looking for the big bag, the kind that farmers use. If they don't have it, find out where the nearest place is that farmers buy their supplies. So
okay.
You could also do this with a rototiller. Add the perlite as you go along. You will find by loosening the soil and adding the perlite, the soil level will rise. But very important, rake off the leaves first. You don't want to incorporate them deeply into the soil because that would be anaerobic. They wouldn't be getting any oxygen, and they could wind up stealing nitrogen from your plants. So you just want to rake off that material and do the soil lightening, whether you double dig or use a rototiller. But then comes the crucial part. Even in a raised bed garden, you're going to have weed seeds in that soil. And by turning the soil over, you will have exposed those seeds to sunlight, which is the trigger for germination. There used to be crazy gardeners who would only do this in the middle of the night under a non-moon. so that no sunlight got through. That's a little excessive, although I do congratulate them. But what I suggest you do is when you're all done lightening up the soil, you level the bed perfectly, and then you water the holy heck out of them. 10 days later, at least in the spring, you'll see a bunch of unwanted plants pop up. So what you need then is a hoe with a very sharp blade, like a razor blade. Generically, they're called diamond hoes. I have no idea why. They have no relationship with diamonds. But you want a really sharp hoe. And what you're going to do is pull that hoe across the soil line, not digging into the soil, but you're going to chop their little heads off. By cutting out their greenery, they won't have any resources to sprout again. I mean, you know, one or two may come back, but you'll take care of 95%. And that's it. Now you're starting out with what farmers call a stale seed bed, meaning they've prevented overwintering weed seeds from taking over the plot.
Okay. I think I can do all that.
Oh, it's really not that difficult. And I would urge you, I know Tennessee, Nashville has a milder climate than I do, but I would urge you to do this early in the spring because you want it to be warm enough, oddly enough, to germinate those weed seeds. And then you put your plants in as the season allows and reuse those shredded leaves as mulch to keep down any new weeds.
Okay.
That's the whole shebang.
If I do all that, you're not thinking I'm going to have to top it off with any additional raised bed soil?
Well, without me seeing it, it's impossible to tell. But there would be no bad reason for you to have, you're buying it by the pickup truck?
Right.
Yeah, you would add some of that in with the perlite if you really have room to make up. And just pile the rest somewhere in the yard, and it will compost down into a single entity.
Okay.
All right?
So you're not... what I read about mushroom compost, I didn't... Unless you had blueberries.
No. That's both totally incorrect. There's no correlation between mushroom soil and blueberries. And I have to be honest and say the explanation for both things, the soil needs of blueberries and mushroom soil are complex, and they would require a whole question of the week or another phone call. But you don't need it, okay?
Okay, that's all I need to know.
Okay, all right, you take care and good luck.
Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and urge everybody out there who is currently enduring a freezing winter to avoid rock salt, aka sodium chloride, as it wreaks havoc on plants, concrete, cars, and all of the wonderful overwintering creatures we're supposed to love. But don't go looking for environmentally safe calcium chloride just yet, because we'll be right back with a preview of the brand new edition of Square Foot Gardening and your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what do you do when a horde of monkeys runs in to ravage your garden? It may not be a common problem for you, but a listener in Japan is waiting for a hopeful answer from me to end the monkey business. You won't want to miss this one. In the meantime, it is now time to welcome our special guest, Rick Bickling from the Square Foot Gardening Foundation and contributing editor to the new book. We are going to speak about the all-new Square Foot Gardening 4th Edition. Rick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks so much for having me on today, Mike.
Well, thank you for being here. I go way back. Mel Bartholomew, as many of our listeners know, passed away years ago. But before that happened, I had the privilege to speak alongside him at many conferences. And actually, you know, the first Square Foot Gardening book was published by Rodale and was instantly the most successful gardening book of all time. Well, they had gotten out of touch with each other. And when I became editor of Organic Gardening magazine in 1992, I got Mel to do a brand new Square Foot article for the magazine. I think it was 10 or 20 new techniques that had cropped up. So Mel and I go way back, and I have noted the various editions of what has now sold in total 3 million copies of Square Foot Gardening books. And this is a very nice one. A lot of changes from the previous editions.
Yes, we really tried to update it a lot more. We've got 200 new photos, 30 new illustrations. Try to make it a little bit more applicable and easy to read for the gardener today.
Well, not only that, Mel and I, as we spoke, he was, of course, into the soil. That was number one. Most people, when they think of square foot gardening, think of the layout, the design, the squares. But Mel was insistent from day one that it was about, quote, Mel's mix, the soil combination that helps your square foot gardening grow to its utmost.
That's correct. It's there's three main pillars to square foot gardening. The first is, rather than filling up a big area of the yard and planting a row garden, you use a raised bed. There's different sizes. We recommend that they're no bigger than 4 feet by 4 feet, because anybody can pretty much reach in 2 feet. But just a raised bed by itself is just the first stepping stone. The really key part, like you said, is the soil mixture, Mel's mix. There's a lot of people that have raised beds, and they might dig up some dirt in the yard and toss it in there, but you really don't know what you're going to get when you do that. I mean, there's...
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. You're going to get poor results. Come on.
You might get some of those monkeys that you were talking about, too. You never know.
Whoa, coming up from the soil? That is a scary... mental image.
So Mel's mix, if you want me to
talk about
that a little bit, it's basically three natural organic components in three equal parts by volume: compost, peat moss, and vermiculite.
I will stop you there and say Mel and I agreed on many things. There's nothing tremendously wrong with vermiculite, which is a substance that allows the bed to drain better. But I feel that perlite, another natural mined mineral, is vastly superior because it not only loosens up the soil, but when it rains, it absorbs some of the soil. It's pockmarked with tiny little holes that lead to caverns and stuff.
Right.
And then, if it's followed by dry times, it releases that water slowly. So it does triple good. And peat moss, you know, that is really under fire these days. I think that peat moss is absolutely necessary to some degree when you're starting seeds. But there is great concern about the sustainability of peat harvesting. So Mike's mix is 1/3 finished compost, 1/3 screened high-quality topsoil, and 1/3 perlite.
Yeah.
We're looking at the same thing. That's what I like. I also like perlite because you get it in a 5-foot-high bag that you can lift with two fingers to show off.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's interesting you brought up the points about vermiculite and peat moss, because really those are two biggest questions we get at the Square Foot Gardening Foundation. You know, do I have to use these? You know, aren't they bad? Aren't we running out? So I did a lot of research, and as far as peat moss, it's true that in many parts of the world it has been over-harvested, but currently Canada provides about 80% of North America's peat moss, and they're doing it in a sustainable manner. There's about 294 million acres of the world's peat lands, or 25% of them, in Canada, and they only harvest peat moss from 54,000 acres. Every year, the peat bogs produce 60 times more peat moss than is harvested, so it's probably not gonna run out anytime soon. And if some of the things you pointed out as positives for peat moss, it's lightweight. It makes your soil lightweight and friable, which promotes seedling emergence, root penetration, and aerial infiltration, and it can absorb up to 20 times its weight in water.
I have read the same studies as you, and in reality, they're talking about European peat moss. Those bogs were devastated, and they ain't coming back. I believe that Canada's are sustainable. Hey, and we may own them soon anyway. So
that's true.
But if people don't want to use it, it's more important for seed starting than it is for building a nice, rich, raised bed. That's
right.
Really a matter of conscience, and I don't want to get stuck on that.
Well, that's a good point, because even if they want to use it, a lot of places in the world, if you're in the forest in the Amazon, you can't just bop on down to the big box store and buy a bag of peat moss and vermiculite. So what we recommend is, if you can't or don't want to use one of the three components, well, compost is essential, but if you don't or can't use peat moss vermiculate, just replace that third of Mel's mix with more compost.
Yes, or again, real nice screened high-quality topsoil, which I go into too much depth teaching people how to judge. Now, I want to talk about the progression to better raised beds in this edition of the book. You do a fabulous job of showing people how to build really high-quality raised beds.
Yeah, I mean, really, you know, the trick is you've got to decide what you're going to build your bed with. Some of the criteria that you might want to use in determining what you're going to use, whether it's wood or concrete block or bricks or steel, you know, buy a steel bed, how much does it cost, how long is it going to last, if you're building it yourself, how easy will it be to build, is it safe? For example, we really strongly recommend you don't use railroad ties.
And oh, my God.
Don't use that.
Yeah, cancer on a creosote, stick.
Yeah, creosote and chromated carbon arsenate are probably not two things you want to be picking with your carrots. So they got to be safe. And really, pressure-treated wood supposedly doesn't use a lot of the chemicals you used to, but I am still kind of leery of it.
Yeah, I don't want it. And there's a reason, cats and kittens, you can get old railroad ties for free, because anytime somebody has a waste product, they think, often in reality, gardeners will pay us for this.
Yeah, there's a lot of waste products that some genius has turned into something that gardeners might want to use. We won't go into all of them, but that's definitely one that you want to steer clear of.
Now, the new square foot gardening edition goes into a lot more detail about things like seed saving and pest protection. It now appears to be not a one-size-fits-all, but it's pretty much all anybody needs to garden well and organically.
Yeah, they've done a real good job with it. You know, we've got some extensive new charts in there that go crop by crop and give you information on how and when to plant. Also, how to tell when it's time to harvest them. That's always a thing that sometimes kind of tricky. You know, hey, are those tomatoes ready? Is that, you know, should I pick my green beans now? So we break it down by each one of the crops and give you all that information. So I think that's a real good improvement.
But would you say the heart and soul of the book is the sacred square foot gardening grid?
Well, it goes hand in hand with the other. You know, you have to have a raised bed to get the Mel's Mix soil in there. And then now that you've got that, if you just go ahead and plant like a row of tomatoes or a row of green beans, you're really wasting space. Well, first let's talk about what the grid is. The grid is a 1-foot by 1-foot grid that you put on top of your bed, whatever size it is. So basically, instead of having a row of carrots, a row of green beans, you work 1 square foot grid at a time, and you'll plant something in one grid and something in another. Now, the spacing of the vegetables is still what it always is. You know, everyone knows when they get a pack of carrots, you look at it and it says plant these 3 inches apart, or tomatoes 1 to 2 feet apart. You're still using that same spacing, but instead of having a big line, you put it in a square. So, for example, carrots, plant them 3 inches apart, and it used to be you'd fill up a big garden, hoe maybe a 4-foot row, put a bunch of carrot seeds in there, and as they grow, you'd thin them out to be about 3 inches apart, and then 3 feet down from that row, you'd put another row in to grow something else. That way you could kind of walk in there in between. So that's 12 square feet and you're growing 16 carrots. Now with square foot gardening, if you take 1 square foot and you just plant 16 carrot seeds in there 3 inches apart, you kind of just like a little checkerboard pattern, you can actually get 16 carrots in 1 square foot. So that's, you know, 12 square feet versus 1 square foot to get 16 carrots. That's a good example.
And I can guarantee that those carrots are going to be longer, straighter, and maybe even sweeter by not being overcrowded. People mistake the idea that you can plant them 3 inches apart, not thinking they're a root crop, and they really want room to grow. For me, if I think of a square foot grid, I think of carrots in it.
That's an excellent thing.
All right. Tell me something you were responsible for in the book that you're especially proud of, or that really is a new addition.
Well, if you're keeping score at home, my garden's actually featured on page 41 of the new book. I've been gardening my entire life. Typically, I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, so kind of up in your neck of the woods.
Hey, I'm going to stop you right there. I'm looking at the picture. Okay. How can you garden if there's a basketball hoop right there?
There you go. That was my problem. I got my Master Gardener certification, and the only area of my yard that had a lot of sunlight was a basketball court. And, you know, we've all seen some little grass or something pop up through a crack in the cement, but I kind of had a hard time picturing how I could do that. So after some research, I came across the square foot gardening method. So basically what it does is it lets anyone grow a garden almost anywhere in any kind of soil, whether you have good soil, bad soil. In my case, no soil. I had concrete, because when you put the raised bed on top, you make your own soil, and Mel's Mix for us, Mike's Mix for you maybe. So you put your own soil in there. And then you put the grid on top, you use some trellises to grow up. And I mean, I've been using this method since 2011 with great success.
And I should add here that there are not only illustrations for how to build many types of raised beds, all of which meet my approval, but you also have some really sturdy trellises that people can build to grow things like pole beans.
And you know, one of the things you might notice in the picture, and I don't know if we mentioned yet, about the size of these raised beds, how deep do they need to be? when you use the Mel's mix formula, you only really need 6 to 8 inches of soil in there. I mean, I've seen some big metal raised beds that are 3-4 feet tall. I mean, that's a lot of stuff to fill in. And
when I'm growing root crops like carrots or potatoes, that's not enough depth for me. So,
and you know, that's a good point you brought up, because one of the things we have in there, we call it a top hat. So basically, if you've got a bed that's 8 inches deep and you want to grow some carrots or potatoes, you basically can make a little square, another 8 inches or however deep you want, plop it on top of that square, and then put some more soil in there. So that kind of bypasses it. Or, like in my case, I just made all my beds, you know, 8 to 10 inches deep. So that way I can kind of put potatoes wherever I want and rotate stuff around.
Mine are 2 feet deep. I'm an overachiever. Okay, one last pitch. Tell me another reason why people should run out or go online and get the all-new fourth edition of Square Foot Gardening.
Well, Square Foot Gardening lets you grow more food in less space with less waste. And it does that by using 80% less space than a traditional row garden. Because you're using less space and you're separating out the growing area from the walking around area, you can use 90% less water, a lot fewer seeds. We figure about 98% less work and half the cost.
All right. Thank you, Rick. We have been talking with Rick Bickling, advisor to the board of directors of the Square Foot Foundation. So again, Rick, thank you. I recommend people go out and check out the Square Foot Gardening 4th edition. It's Cool Springs, distributed by Quarto. All right, thanks for being with us, man.
Thanks a lot.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and inform everyone out there who's dealing with deep snow not to shovel it onto your lawn or garden if that snow has been exposed to rock salt or even one of the alternative ice melters. But don't go trying to unshovel just yet, because we'll be right back to help you save your garden from marauding monkeys and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from NPR station WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Getting double duty from your garden space is all the rage. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll describe some great ideas that allow you to use one space for two crops. Plus your fabulous phone calls. Maybe something else. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another fabulous edition of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and yes, we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens, and we have a question of the week coming up for you that you were not expecting. How to protect your garden and fruit trees from monkeys. We're not kidding, and you'll find out what we mean after some fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, hello, Mike. So very nice to talk to you, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
Altoona, Pennsylvania, central part of the state.
Yes, I know where that is. And what can we do you for?
Okay, I've got a city plot. I've got two little peach trees planted back there. The soil is kind of wet, so I raised them up about a foot above the stagnant area, but it dries out.
Oh, no, 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 stop right there. This area is constantly wet?
No, intermittently when it rains, but then it dries out.
Okay.
I've got runoff from the houses above me, so.
Okay, that's a common problem. Take a look at that runoff. Is there any way you can divert it, maybe using gutters or a berm, so it doesn't saturate the area of the peach trees?
I'll put a berm in. I can do that.
Okay. So you got two peach trees.
Yep.
How old?
And they were supposed to be Albertas, but they made white peaches last year, and I probably got 300 to 400 peaches. They're in their third year now, and I pruned them to open center, according to the way Mike Parker does at North Carolina State Extension. Okay. And I've been doing dormant oil sprays and trying to spray for insects when the bees aren't flying. So anyway, I talked to the Penn State guys, and I was going to prune them like in February or January last year because I was going out of town, but they said, don't do it because you wait for the buds to swell, but if you prune too early, it stimulates hormones that tell the plant to start growing for 18 days, like in the middle of the winter. So that's why I didn't do it. And I'm also about worried if I prune too early, I have open wounds that maybe will get infected or, you know, harm the tree. So
that's rarely a problem, the open wound issue. But congratulations, Penn State. The same is true in the fall. People who prune fruit trees in the fall stimulate growth, then they get a hard freeze, and it can kill the tree. And obviously the same is going to be true in the spring. You get out there on a nice day, way too early in the season, sun shining, it's 60 degrees, you prune, and the next thing you know, the weather guessers are saying, it's an Arctic blast coming down from Canada. And the sap inside actually freezes and you harm the tree. No, you either prune when the tree is totally dormant and is not going to come out of dormancy, like midwinter, when if nobody wants to do it, that's probably the time to do it. Or when they start growing in the spring. Now, are you going to be gone again this spring?
I'm not planning to, so I should have time to plant it whenever, or prune it whenever you say it's the proper time.
Okay. Here's what I suggest. You wait until the flowers open. You know how beautiful those flowers are, so enjoy that, because you seem to have been very successful with your peaches, which makes you the odd man out. Peaches are probably the hardest thing to grow organically or so-called conventionally. So after the flowers have faded, then I suggest you prune out one-third of the tree, focusing, as you have said, on opening up the center. And then do you thin the fruits as they develop?
I didn't last year, but I will this year.
Yeah. Take off at least every other peach, especially when they're touching each other. And then if the tree starts to get overly lush, prune again, pruning off branches, ideally that don't have any peaches growing on them or look weak or brittle. Peach trees grow faster than any other fruit tree, and it's imperative to keep airflow in them. Now, you mentioned earlier that you use dormant oil in the winter. Have you had peach tree borer problems?
One of my peach trees was killed 2 years ago by borer, yeah.
Yeah, that's a very common occurrence. All right, I approve of the dormant oil spray. As you move into the season, simply move to a summer spray. Dormant oil is a petroleum product, and it's okay to use. It's fine. It's necessary for the health of the tree. But as you get to the spring, you move to a summer spray, which is based on vegetable oil. It's much lighter and kinder to a growing tree.
Okay.
All right, man. I'm envious of your harvest. You're obviously doing a lot of things right.
It's sheer dumb luck. Everything else doesn't do so well, but the peaches seem to, so... Thanks, Mike.
All right. So good luck to you and your peaches, man.
Thanks a million. It's been a wonderful time.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yes, once again, it is time for an all-new question of the week. Yes, I missed you guys, too, which we are calling Monkeys Are Attacking My Fruit Trees. Chuck Kaser, rhymes with laser, sends this week's missive from his Midori farm in Kyoto, Japan. He begins with a salutation, Domo Arigato, Mr. Roboto, the first part of which is the formal Japanese phrase for thank you very much. While Mr. Roboto references an unusual song by the band Styx from their 1982 album Kilroy Was Here. The song, about robots, became an unexpected hit, and the phrase appeared all over in pop culture, including on The Simpsons. Okay, we move on. But before we do, a quick digression compiled from several internet sources. Kyoto, officially Kyoto City, is the capital of Kyoto Prefecture in the Kansai region of Japan's largest and most populous island of Honshu. Kyoto is known as the City of a Thousand Temples, a testament to the many temples and shrines steeped in centuries of spiritual tradition. Wander through towering vermilion gates, serene gardens raked smooth by monks, and up to mountaintop shrines that whisper of ancient rituals. Back to Chuck, who writes, I am a longtime listener and have advanced in my growing skills immensely due to your generous advice. Thank you so much for the years of wit and wisdom, making my long drives to the garden slash farm as enjoyable as the time I spend there. I should mention, as you would insist, that I reside in Kyoto City, Japan, and my farms and gardens are located in the mountains just north of the city. It's difficult to judge what growing zone in the United States is most like my own, but let's say it's about 6B, 7A, one which you are quite familiar. I am an organic grower slash farmer of mainly vegetable varieties numbering somewhere around 50. But this question is about my little fruit garden. I have three lemon trees, a loquat, a fig, two pawpaws, four blueberries, and a raspberry that are all 2 to 3 years old. I want to move a lot of them to one of my farm areas that has a proper fence, as the monkey encroachment in the original garden has become just too much. Yes, monkeys. If there is an animal in existence to vie with your evil squirrels for top invader, it is the Japanese macaw. Troops of 30 to 40 regularly test my mettle and devour my daikon radishes. So I have decided to move my fruit trees. Should I soak the ground with water and then pull them out by hand? Or would digging them out be better? It is mid-fall as I write this. Should I do it ASAP? Or do you think it would be better left until another time? But no matter what, no more monkey business. I am ready to partake in the fruits of my labor. I am among the many listeners who are looking forward to more great programming from you, Ducky, and everybody else on your team, and any advice would be most appreciated. Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto. P.S. If anyone listening wants to know more about how food systems work in Japan, please look me up. That goes for rock star radio host as well. If I see one, I'll let him know. And Chuck's website is MIDORIFRUIT ArmKYOTO.com. All right, here's my answer. You're very welcome for my advice, but as I have to prove on many web pages, I am not a robot. Okay, let's start with the pawpaws. You might be able to transplant a little baby tree, but the taproot grows fast and deep, and trying to transplant a mature tree is doomed to failure, as is the case with other plants with deep taproots. And propagation from cuttings requires a specific rootstock, which may not be available in Japan. The preferred propagation method is to grow new trees from seed, which is reported to work well. I'll include a link to an immensely helpful pawpaw bulletin from Purdue University that explains everything with the written version of this question of the week at the Gardens Alive website, where you'll find us under Garden Resources. Raspberries. My canes emerge from the ground as shoots in the spring and produce large clusters of raspberries at the very tips of their canes at the end of the season. If you don't foolishly cut them back, they will produce a huge crop all up and down the canes in early to midsummer of the following year, and then those canes will turn brittle and die. Existing raspberries do not transplant well, but the baby canes that emerge every spring are easy to move to another location. Blueberries grow in a bush form that is relatively easy to transplant. Use shovels to dig a wide island around the plants before they flower, then push the shovels deeper underneath until you can lift the entire plant out, roots, soil, and all. Strongly acidify the new hole with sulfur or milled peat moss. This only applies to blueberries. Plop the plant in its new hole and water well until abundant rains appear. Use the same gentle tush-push shoveling procedure with the trees, then replant at the same height they were or higher. Make sure that root flare is visible. Only fill the hole with native soil and add no mulch. Instead, spread 2 inches of finished compost over the area, beginning 6 inches away from the trunk and going outward at least as far as the furthest branches are going to reach. Water well, especially during dry spells and especially during the first 2 years. And finally, your fig will grow easily from new growth cut in the spring. No rootstock required. Well, that sure was some great information about moving your plants out of harm's way. Now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure at the Gardens Alive section of the Gurney's website. Just visit the Gardens Alive section of the Gurney's website and click on Garden Resources. Yikes, my producer is threatening to deliver unto me a troop of monkeys. If I don't get out of this studio, we must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100, extension number 3, or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming, to our garden shore at our new email site, youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Either way, please, 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 please include your location and your phone number if you're feeling especially kind. You'll find our new phone number our new email address, a link to the Gardens Alive archive of previous answers, and new and improved links to our numerous podcast sites. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was made in America using foreign and domestic parts. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Check out her fine work and join our cockamamie horticultural community at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprope. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our guardian angel is the lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the legendary awesome ninja Sean. We thank our special guest, Rick Bickling, for discussing the all-new fourth edition of the classic Square Foot Gardening book with us today. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and if the weather here continues to stay colder than Alaska, I may just leave my Christmas lights up until summer. But in the meantime, I'll see you again next week.